Hello and welcome to Dealcast, the M&A podcast from Merger Markets. I'm Juliana Needham. In this episode, we're heading east to explore what's going on in private equity in Asia. Now, whilst the impact of geopolitical turmoil is unavoidable, innovation continues apace, particularly in China and India. And whilst current dislocation can be seen as a risk, it's also an opportunity. To find out more, Justin Niesner, the Associate Editor of the Asia Venture Capital Journal, spoke to Pamela Fung, who is a Managing Director and Partner at Morgan Stanley Private Equity Solutions.
Hi, Pam. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Justin. Thanks for having me today.
So the topic is Asia private equity in the current macro context. And obviously, there's a lot going on in the world globally, a lot of dislocation that kind of influences the way investors think. So I want to start high level with that thought, and then hopefully we can get into some more interesting detail. But what does the global dislocation that we're seeing in various aspects of the macro mean for Asia private equity from where you're sitting?
That's a very broad question, but very relevant one in the current market. So I've been in this industry for 15 years now. And for the first, you know, almost decade, we used to say that private equity doesn't change that much year to year. But ironically, in the last 5-6 years, it feels like it's been one event after another. So obviously, COVID was a big one. We had the China regulatory reset, tariffs, the SaaSpocalypse, and now the situation in the Middle East. So for sure, it's kept us investors on our toes. But I think the gist of these dislocations is that, you know, quote unquote, the perceived risk is heightened. And in a higher risk environment, that generally deters investors away from Asia, because Asia in general is perceived to be a higher risk market. So as a result, we see fundraising, deals, exits, all of them have slowed. But then the question is, you know, is the environment really that, you know, quote unquote, risky? So I think as an investor, as a private equity investor, investing with a 5-10 year timeframe, you do need to think about some of these dislocations and risks as part of the investment decision. So for example, pointing to tariffs. So Liberation Day in April 2025, it feels like it caught a lot of investors off guard. The stock markets reacted pretty violently. But then I do remember going over old investment committee memos. And frankly, we had been discussing the possibility of tariffs in IC significantly before Liberation Day. So as we all know, one of the US president's hot button topics is trade and tariffs. So, you know, I think a lot of us could see it coming, you know, from quite a ways away. That being said, so within Morgan Stanley, we're lucky to have access to, you know, really great research. And they had some really good analysis, both several months before, but also after Liberation Day. They broke down the potential impacts on different geographies, different sectors. And what we did with that was we took a look at that, put an overlay on our private equity portfolio, and especially as we were thinking about it for every country in Asia. And then when we actually drilled down to specific funds and companies, we found that the potential impact of tariffs was quite manageable. So it just goes to show from a portfolio construction perspective, but also a deal-making perspective, I think, you know, any sensible private equity investor should be thinking about these potential factors as they're thinking about a, you know, 3-5 year investment time horizon. Another example of this is private education in China. So I remember coming across, again, some Morgan Stanley research reports from a few years prior to when the regulation came into place. There were already concerns about education inequality, you know, concerns about the, you know, private education becoming, you know, a little bit too much. And interestingly, I remember talking to a GP, this is probably 2017 timeframe or so, where they had done quite a few education deals in their prior firm. But what we found was that at his new firm, he had not done any education deals, citing some noise in the space. So I think as an investor, as a private equity investor, whether you're looking at Asia or whether you're looking at global markets, I think your job is to stay close to these sector trends, envision how the industry and the regulation might play out, and try to invest on the right side of how things might play out.
Yeah, thanks for that. It's an interesting point that, you know, obviously when people are shying away for whatever reason in the kind of background market situation, it presents opportunities to be countercyclical, doesn't it?
Yeah. So I think, you know, you can see it as a dislocation, you can see it as part of the cycle. But I think really we can see every risk or dislocation as an opportunity. So I think it, you know, for example, will lead to more scope for negotiating valuations, will lead to more creativity in deal making, more motivated sellers. So one example I always point to is Qadara Fund 1 in 2013, when global investors were shying away from India because of currency and macro reasons. And then that ended up being a great buying opportunity for them. But also I think it's informed how they think about their strategy and organization even today. So I think bad markets are a time when GPs, they really get tested. They really think about what they're doing. And especially for those who plan to be in this for the long term, they're thinking really hard about how to refine their strategies and organizations so that they can perform irrespective of market cycles. So I think, you know, yes, dislocation, it's seen as a risk, but it's also your opportunity as well.
So let's talk like specifically opportunities like for 2026. We're still early in the year. Based on what we're seeing, I mean, you mentioned the tariffs, it's been going on for a while. SaaSpocalypse is a much newer phenomenon. We've got the disruption in the Middle East. I mean, how does all this play into what you expect in terms of deployment in the year to come?
I think it's going to be quite an interesting year. So already, you know, we're in March right now, and already we've had SaaSpocalypse. I think, you know, the general consensus there is the pendulum swung a little bit far in terms of how some of these software companies have been viewed. But in reality, it's something that private equity investors have been thinking about for several years now. A lot of us have seen AI emerging in our VC portfolios quite early on. And then thinking about impact on software and SaaS, I think private equity investors have been thinking about that for 2, 3, 4 years already. The Middle East is a little bit more abrupt. At this point, it's quite hard to see how the situation will play out, how long this will sustain. So I think for Asian private equity specifically, at a minimum, you know, it's affecting travel. So it's affecting US and European investors from flying to certain locations across Asia. And, you know, there's a real safety cost and, you know, people's lives element here. In terms of specific economic impacts, oil prices may affect the more oil-dependent and export-oriented countries like India and Korea. And there's, of course, spillover effects affecting domestic consumption, inflation, et cetera. That being said, I think in terms of private equity, the nice thing about private equity is there's always something interesting to do. So I think the two themes I'd point to in terms of where the opportunity is for 2026, one is domestic themes. So thinking about Asia, we still have, for a lot of the countries, it's still interesting demographics. There's still underpenetrated industries. There's still potential for leapfrog growth. I'd also point to efficiency plays and consolidation as interesting domestic themes. The other really interesting theme that we observed during our travels last year is that we're seeing a lot of innovation from across Asia. And, you know, this is cutting edge, globally leading innovation, which we view is, you know, for sure cheaper, more capital efficient, better, and maybe even faster than other global markets.
Thanks for that. Can I bounce off the innovation piece? Because I think that's interesting, particularly from an Asia perspective. It seems like it's become something of a draw globally. Can I ask you for a word on that, what you're seeing?
Yeah, so when it comes to innovation in Asia, I think China's probably the most obvious one. Thinking back to some of the news and headlines in recent years, I think DeepSeek, which emerged in early 2025, really awakened the world to the fact that AI has arrived in China. And everybody did take note that it was developed for a fraction of the cost of ChatGPT. That being said, those of us who are closer to the local markets, we've seen some pretty interesting companies emerge in Chinese VC funds that have been invested, you know, several years ago, frankly, like Zhipool, Moonshot, and Minimax. So I think, you know, this is a trend that we saw early signs of. And I think the DeepSeek moment was really just brought that to the broader public's attention. Another big theme in China innovation is robotics. So again, 2025, and also continuing through this year, 2026, We saw these humanoid robots emerge during the Chinese New Year performance in China and also at CES. So there's a lot of innovation that's capturing the global community in terms of innovation coming out of China. That being said, one interesting juxtaposition is that we're seeing these really interesting innovations, but given the current market backdrop, we're seeing that because fundraising is difficult, because of the headlines on China, the valuations actually have become, you know, quite interesting. Entrepreneurs are, you know, it's not guaranteed that they'll be able to raise the next round. So entrepreneurs are having to be much more careful in terms of the cash that they're using. So much more capital efficient. And maybe one point to make here is that for our global VC program, we've always been focused on capital efficiency. We prefer to invest in VCs where they have unique insights, they're backing technology years ahead before they become mainstream. We're looking for GPs who are also pretty hands-on with the companies. So entrepreneurs see them as value-add investors to their cap tables, whether they're providing strategic advice or operational improvement. So last cycle in China was not quite that. We saw a lot of capital rushing into China. It was not capital efficient. It was almost opposite of the investment philosophy that I was just talking about. But I think that, you know, the market shakeout over the last few years, valuations becoming much more reasonable. We're also seeing the VCs who are active right now increase focus and specialization. So I think China, you know, the interesting innovation and more capital efficient models, I think that should lead to a pretty interesting market opportunity.
Well, how does that capital efficient innovation story play out in India, for example? I mean, that's one of the most attractive markets that we've seen in the recent term, and valuations have always been an issue in that market, but it's been quite active lately. Is that story, or like, what are you seeing in terms of that capital efficient innovation story in India?
India is also a very interesting market. So India originally, you know, 20 years ago or so, started out as more of a India to global BPO market. In the last decade or so, we've seen India to global as a software SaaS play. And in recent years, we're starting to see unique deep tech themes as well. So we've seen some like drone companies, space tech, et cetera. The other thing to note about India is from a policy perspective, there's a lot of significant digital tailwinds. So like Aadhaar, so basically digital identities, UPI, instantaneous digital payments. And there's a lot of other supportive government policy like the Made in India initiative as well. So India, lots of interesting tailwinds and interesting themes. We like India for the fact that there's a deep talent pool, but there's also price points are significantly lower. And because of that, there's a much higher bar in terms of capital efficiency. So for example, last year, there was a lot of talk about the quick commerce model. So Blinkit, Zepto, think companies like that, which basically the gist of these businesses is it becomes profitable to deliver groceries or other goods, even at a very low minimum order amount. So India as a whole, you know, deep tech talent, we're seeing more and more innovation coming out of that market. But there's an inherent focus on capital efficiency and ROIC in that market. So that's also, it's a pretty interesting market to us.
Does that opportunity hold up across the rest of the region? Japan and Australia have seen a lot of traction lately. And I know there's a lot of crossover in terms of backdrop similarities between Southeast Asia and India. I mean, if we just kind of look across the region and we think about that innovation piece, what stands out to you?
Yeah. So I think the interesting thing about this current point in time is innovation can come from everywhere. So especially given all the AI, vibe coding, you know, being able to do things from your mobile phone. So you can have an innovative company started from, you know, anywhere in the world, and it can be a small team. It can be started pretty easily. So the barriers to starting a globally leading innovation company, that's really come down quite significantly. In terms of Asia, I would divide it into, there's the more sort of deep tech innovative markets. There's also those where application of technology can lead to, I'll call it leapfrog growth. So you mentioned Australia, Japan. Australia, it's a pretty interesting market. We spent quite a bit of time looking at that in the last few years. Atlassian, Canva have obviously put Australia on the map. But as we were conducting our market survey, what we found was that the Aussies really punch above their weight in terms of unicorns per capita. And that's because of the deep talent pool, their focus on product-led growth. So if you think about it, you know, Australia is very far away from the rest of the world. So as a result, a lot of these entrepreneurs are having to develop technologies, think about being global from day one, but also thinking about how do they take these technologies and sell them to other countries. So they're very much focused on capital efficient, product-led growth. So we found a lot of VCs and companies where this idea of capital efficiency, the value-add approach, and unique insights in terms of the technology, we see that feature quite heavily in Australian VC. In Japan, we see similar characteristics. So obviously there's a legacy of tech talent in that market. It's also a very capital efficient market because of the dearth of VC financing there. So it's a market that I think is in the very early days. But that being said, we see that there's a strong push by the government for tech development as well as entrepreneurialism. So I think that's also a market to watch as well. Turning to some of these more application of technology markets. So I think a lot of investors will ask about Southeast Asia. We see that it holds the same promise as, you know, China back 10, 15 years ago, where the economy is still very much underpenetrated, fast growing, young population. So we see that applying technologies to sectors that are less developed. So for example, financial services, e-commerce is also, you know, pretty interesting opportunity as well. I think the key there is to be selective and, again, focus on capital efficiency.
Yeah, thanks for that, Pam. I wanted to ask you about how all of this plays into fundraising, actually. And I guess when it comes to the capital efficient innovation point, it's a draw for Asia, clearly, to be able to develop technology cheaper. But in terms of really moving the needle on overall regional fundraising, maybe it's kind of a minor factor. But we've also got the macro backdrop, and we've got the war in the Middle East and tariffs. And by comparison, a lot of Asian markets might look more stable than they used to. Just kind of like pulling all that in, I mean, do you have kind of a big picture view of where fundraising is going in the region?
So one interesting trend that we observed in the last year or so as more uncertainty in the global macro environment, we saw investors begin to think about more diversification globally. So initially, I think the last cycle, there were quite a few investors who allocated quite a fair bit to the US, believing that the US, the deepest private equity market and one of the more consistent, strong performing markets. But what we saw last year was we saw some investors beginning to allocate to Europe. And then second half of last year, we saw investors really thinking about diversification in Asia. I think India and Japan were the primary beneficiaries of this. But at the same time, we also saw renewed interest in China after a few years of caution around China. That being said, in terms of how we see fundraising for this year, the reality of it is 70-80% of the fundraising dollars are skewed towards the larger funds. They're quite sizable relative to the rest of the market. And then so the fundraising totals will be very skewed towards these larger funds. And this year in particular, we do have quite a few that are in the market. For example, there's several who essentially the funds were raised last year, but they will have their final closes this year. So think names like Bain Asia, Baring EQT, Blackstone. And there's also a few that are coming to market this year, and we expect to see them have closes as well. So for example, KKR and Hill House. So given that quite a few of these groups are fundraising this year, I think, we'll actually see, despite the broader dislocation and macro backdrop I was talking about earlier, I think we'll see, fundraising numbers up this year.
Yeah, we've been tracking that phenomenon of the consolidation of the GP space and these larger funds, fewer funds, larger funds. What are your thoughts on that phenomenon in general? I mean, if we're going to see that kind of play out again this year, I mean, from the perspective of like Morgan Stanley making LP commitments, that LP viewpoint, what do you think is what are the implications of that trend?
So going back to how LPs think about Asia, so obviously you have a choice between larger, generally regional funds, and then smaller country funds or VC funds. And I think a lot of what we discussed today is focused on innovation and VC funds and country-specific funds. But I think in reality, an investor coming in from outside of the region, or even some investors in the region, but maybe they're focused on, they're located in one country, but looking to invest across all of Asia. I think that investors find it difficult to understand the nuances of each country. And then that can often be their biggest barrier in terms of pulling the trigger. And then my view is that unless you're on the ground and constantly tracking these markets, it can be pretty hard to get comfort with some of the more country-specific or sector-specific strategies. Maybe one point to make is, so we see this gap between, you know, investors hearing about some of these themes and being very interested to invest in some of these, you know, getting access to innovation and some of these more sector or country-specific ideas, but not fully understanding them and not having the comfort to invest in them. What we've been trying to do is write a few papers on helping international investors demystify Asia. We had been doing this internally for a very long time. What we do is we do surveys on different market segments. Usually we pick two or three, you know, by geography, by sector segments. We spend time meeting with relationship GPs on the ground, talk to their companies. We also talk to different parts of Morgan Stanley as well. So for example, our macro teams, capital markets teams, we do use AVCJ data. So we should mention that as well. And then what we do is we take these cross-sectional insights and then compile them together, document them as market surveys. So some of these can be pretty extensive. You know, we have some that go 50, 60 pages long. And the idea is to cover, you know, what are the key themes in each market. We'll talk about valuations, exit markets, how do you get your money in and out, topics like that. So I raise that because for a long time, we were using them more internally, sharing them with select clients. But we're trying to also help the broader community. We've started writing a series. We've called it Why Invest in Asian Private Equity. We have them on our MSIM website. But the idea is really to help international investors try to demystify the region and hopefully get more comfort and hopefully, you know, actually invest in the region.
The exit market in Asia, always a concern for global LPs and always kind of something that they point to when they talk about lower appetite for Asia. What are your thoughts? I mean, just based on, I mean, we've been talking about some of the background drivers of the market and deal flow. How does that shape the exit outlook for Asia from your view?
Yeah. So I think Asia has the common perception that DPI is thinner or it lags Western private equity markets. So, and then that's also difficult, makes this current environment quite difficult because without the exits, then LPs are less willing to redeploy and invest in new funds. So, you know, exits has always been a big concern of investors investing in Asia. That being said, the exit markets do continue to evolve. There's been significant reform and evolution over the last you know, several years. And these are also constantly changing markets. So there's a lot of reform that's still ongoing. So in terms of the IPO markets, so for, I'll call it, you know, a large portion of Asia, these are minority stake investing markets. And the predominant channel for exits is IPOs. So think markets like China and India. So while the US continues to have the deepest stock market by market cap and trading volumes, we should note that China, including Hong Kong, and the Indian stock markets have really developed. And actually, 2025 was a record year for IPOs in those markets. So for example, Hong Kong was actually the largest IPO market in 2025. In India, although the IPO sizes tend to be smaller, it was actually the most active IPO market in terms of number of IPOs. So, you know, pretty significant milestones there. Over the last few years, I'm not sure if global investors are aware, but these IPO markets have all become, you know, there's been significant reform by each of the local stock exchanges. So these markets have, you know, each of them have become more receptive to fast-growing tech companies. They've really deepened in terms of investor support, whether that's foreign or domestic investors, or whether that's institutional versus retail investors. And I think also that for all of these stock exchanges, they've become more focused on transparency and governance. So all in all, these markets have really deepened and evolved. So thinking about IPO as an exit avenue for private equity and VC companies, for both Chinese and Indian companies, IPO has become a more consistent and repeatable avenue. as opposed to, you know, in the past when it was viewed to be a pretty bumpy, very uneven form of exit. So, you know, I just talked about Chinese and Indian companies, but we've actually seen reform across, you know, many markets across all of Asia. So, you know, think Japan, Southeast Asia, et cetera. So this is a continuous evolution in the markets.
How does that compare to the M&A picture for exits?
Yeah, M&A definitely improving across emerging Asia. It's probably more of a feature in developed Asia, where these are generally more buyout heavy markets. So think Australia and Japan. So there we see more exits through trade sales. And if you think about M&A in those markets, it's actually fairly robust. One market to point to is Australia, for example, where, you know, Australia is pretty wide open for mid-sized exits. So you get both regional and global sponsors, but also Western strategics participating in the trade sales of these companies. It ends up being a market where a lot of these groups are pretty comfortable investing in, even though it is remote from a geographical perspective. And that's because of comfort with the language, culture, and jurisdiction. So I think M&A, we're also seeing it evolve in both India and China, parts of Southeast Asia, et cetera. So I think this, again, is a space where we continue to see reform and evolution and feeling more comfortable with how the markets are evolving. So I think one point to make here is historically, the private equity markets in Asia are newer than their Western counterparts. So I think historically, many GPs, especially those that are earlier in their evolution, they were more focused on the upfront deal-making part, as opposed to thinking about the exits. And, you know, frankly, you know, for a lot of the investments, the asset quality was a bit mixed. So as a result, at the back end, it was more difficult to exit companies like that. So I think the industry as a whole, much more focus on, you know, are these well-positioned assets that can eventually be sold, whether through IPO and M&A. So for example, for us, it's always been part and parcel of our DNA. So as we're thinking about underwriting deals, we're always checking with our banking side in terms of what the exit prospects are for that geography. You know, is this an IPO exit? Is this an M&A exit? For this business model, what does that look like? So we almost think, you know, is there a plan A, B, C? For the broader private equity community in Asia, I think the pool of GPs is deepening. So with improved ability to select and cultivate well-positioned assets, more thoughtfulness in pre-wiring the exits, and then also just given what I talked about earlier in terms of IPO and M&A markets, deepening reforms there, I think we will see Asian exit activity and DPI improve over time.
So just thinking about global appetite for Asia, I mean, one of the main barriers there has always been this idea that the exit markets in Asia are underwhelming, people aren't seeing the exits, and that's kind of dampened global appetite. How do we turn the corner on that mindset in terms of the way people think about Asian exit markets? So we were speaking before about demystifying the region and educating the region. I mean, is there some of that work that needs to be done in terms of understanding exit markets in Asia?
So we always caveat that past performance is not an indicator of future performance. And with Asia, that's very true, but in a good way. So LPs can't get too bogged down thinking about what has gone wrong with their Asia portfolio in the past and just say, you know, I'm not going to do that again. I'm not going to touch that again. So in Asia, markets and GPs can evolve very quickly, and you always need to take a forward point of view. So we try to do that in a systematic way through market research, market surveys, deep research, leveraging industry contacts, the broader Morgan Stanley network. So for example, when it comes to exits, we're always talking with our banking side, asking them about how to think about the exits in this geography, in this sector, what's the plan A, B, C. So I think thinking of all these factors, the deepening maturity of the local GPs, their increased ability to select good assets, more thoughtfulness on pre-wiring exits, as well as evolution in the IPO and M&A markets, I think we'll see Asian exits and DPI improving over time.
Very good. I think that that brings us to a good stopping point, Pam. Thanks so much for joining us and for sharing your thoughts.
Appreciate being here today, sharing more about the markets. As mentioned, you know, the current dislocation in the global markets, Asian markets, it might feel uncomfortable, but it can also be an opportunity. But to capture these opportunities, so you want to be forward-looking, ahead of the curve, and very research and insights-oriented.
Thanks very much.
That was Justin Niesner, the associate editor of the Asia Venture Capital Journal, speaking to Pamela Fung, a managing director and partner at Morgan Stanley Private Equity Solutions. This episode was recorded on the 25th of March. Thanks for listening to Dealcast, the M&A podcast from Mergermarket. For more information about this conversation, have a look at our show notes. Follow and subscribe on your favourite podcast app, and do join us again next time.